Somewhere in Raqqa sits a schoolhouse where children learn and play. From across the cement yard, you can see the large building. New windows, new paint, new doors. You can hear the children laughing as they walk up the steps to start their classes. The scene cuts to years prior. International Freedom Battalion fighters stand in the schoolyard, raising their weapons in triumph. The school is graffitied, pocked with bullet holes, and has more fighters on the roof, surrounded by barrels and sandbags. Both of these images were captured in the movie Bilki Sibe.
The film is sort of a crazy idea, and I didn't really ever believe it would be released, because basically I just met a Greek guy in the middle of Manbij in 2016. The battle just ended, and he was introduced to me through some Turkish friends, and he said he was making a documentary, and I was like, oh, that's okay. But he also has a gun. He's also in the same unit as me. So the idea of sort of filming a documentary about a war while you're fighting in a war was something that seemed like such a Herculean task that I never thought I'd see the light of day, but he managed to go back, the director, my comrade, and he went back. He, you know, as I'm sure you've seen in the film, he interviewed a lot of people and sort of just made this incredible snapshot of what it was like in, 2016, and then later in what would be 2021, about, sort of what we saw from our perspective as internationalists in Northeast Syria.
You are hearing internationalist Guy Stewart. Guy, thanks for spending some time with me. So this movie covers a lot of ground. If you could tell viewers just what it is shortly.
So I guess it's broken up into three different parts, but overarchingly, it's about it's a soldier's film that's documenting one soldier's experience in the International Freedom Battalion, which is the left-wing internationalist organization. And from what I mentioned previously about like the disparate times of showing the front, showing gunfights, showing, the slow march of like liberation into Daesh-held territories, juxtaposed with these sort of long progressing social formations in society that have been building in Northeast Syria since about at least 2012, 2013. So it's, I hope that answers the question. Sorry, as someone who's seen the movie, you understand there's quite a bit going on, but I think that might be the quickest I can do it.
So what do you think could possess someone to both fight in and film a war? It seems kind of like a Heraclean task, if you will.
Well, he could describe it much better than I could, but as I describe it, or as it's been described to me, I should say, basically there was an announcement in I believe in the square in Exarchia, for those who don't know, is like an anarchist controlled neighborhood in Athens. And there was an announcement by several communist parties, mostly of Turkish backing, that they were going to make this basically internationalist battalion in Syria to fight ISIS. This would have been the summer of 2015, I believe. And he just happened to be there or knew some people who were there. And, I think the idea must have slowly come together at first, but the way that he's told it to me is that basically they went from being in Greece to being on the front lines in with a camera and a gun in like, I believe it's something crazy, like 3 weeks, 4 weeks, which is just like an insane amount of time. Like I spent a month, just to give everyone listening an idea, I spent a month just in Sulaymaniyah trying to get across into Rojava. So to go from staying in a cafe in Athens to like on the front lines of Manbij in like 3 or 4 weeks is just like, it's insane that it happened. I like, if I didn't know it and I didn't know the people who did it and have been friends and comrades with them for so many years, I wouldn't believe it was real. It just doesn't seem like it would work. But somehow he was able to pull it off.
And for the viewers out there, who's this he we're talking about here?
It's Alexis de Lumis. He's a documentary filmmaker and I guess you would say like a movement media person from Greece. And he has sort of, I think, been around in the indie media scene for a couple decades at this point, and does a lot of sort of independent reporting from, I believe, Greece and some other Balkan countries, I believe.
Art can sometimes be as consuming as war. You don't just finish shooting and call it a day. Whether you're grading edits or rebuilding communities, you've committed yourself to building the promise you sold yourself. This is how Alexis puts it.
Kind of ruined my life a little bit. Well, it took a very, very long time to make this movie and very copious effort. My life's been revolving around this issue in the government pretty much for the best part of the last decade. From the moment of conception, let's say, to the very final cut, it was more than 7 years. And there is a number of reasons for that, because like these 7 years also included a second time going to Northeast Syria, like for some, let's say, additional update footage. And like to that effect, even the pandemic played a role in all of this, in the delay of the film and like the difficulty in finishing it. Because I was originally a soldier in the war against ISIS with the Syrian Democratic Forces in the years 2016 and 17 for a year and a half. From the summer, 1st of July, we arrived. 2016 to the end of 2017. And I was recording whenever it was possible, really. I was going to say this whole time, but in fact, it was whenever it was possible, because it is, let me tell you, it is quite an insane thing to do to yourself, to be a soldier and a filmmaker at the same time. I recorded stuff from the front lines and interviews and other things like during this period of 1.5 years. And then I went back to Northeast Syria in the autumn of 2021. And I had to wait for the whole fucking pandemic to finish to do that, you know, so that was also a factor.
You say this film has taken the better part of a decade. Is this the film you set out to make, or did your plans evolve when you were making it?
First of all, like when you shoot a documentary like that, given the whole predicament I described, it's not very heavily scripted beforehand, you know? You kind of figure it out along the way. Yeah, you have some sort of basic idea about the kind of thing you want to convey, you know, and how you want to approach it or whatever. But at the end of the day, it's like you're there to record what happens while you're there, and you're not aware. Like, first of all, when I first went there, we can start with that. When I first went there, I supposedly went there for 6 months. And I ended up saying a year and a half. So there you go. Already, that's a big change of plans. But that's more than a change of plans for the documentary. It's a change of the overall plan. Because, you know, this kind of situation has a way of kind of sucking you in. And it's a big, like, you're part of something. You become part of something that is a pretty big deal. It's a, like, you become part of like historical moments and historical events, and you kind of want to see it through. So it's not It's not a random time that we went, like we went back after the liberation of Raqqa, like after we could, you know, we could say, I mean, there was still some Daesh, ISIS like fighters in Deir ez-Zor and so on, and there was like the war continued for some time, but after liberating Raqqa, it was the destruction of the caliphate. Like there was no more caliphate. They were defeated. They were thoroughly, you know, defeated at this point. So there was, it was a, like a point of closure. Yeah. So there you go. Like, first of all, yeah, it's, I went there for 6 months and ended up staying for 18. So that's one change along the way. In the more filmic, like cinematic yeah, in terms of the film itself, this is a bit more niche question and answer in that sense, but like I did what, like one thing that comes to mind, I wouldn't say that something changed very dramatically in terms of how I envisioned it after I came back, for example, the first time, but there was some there was some things that developed, some elements. The first one that comes to mind is that in my head, I was carrying the idea, because I've done some smaller films kind of like that before, and different films as well, that there would, that my voice would not appear in the film, that there would be no narration, like me, narration of my own voice. And then gradually, people started telling me that that's not a good idea, like even people that we were there together, and they also are involved in filmmaking, you know, and so on. And finally Lou, the first editor, like first chronologically, Louise Bruchard, the one of the two editors, really insisted that I need to do this. That already, it was Lou's idea to go back as well. So basically, we kind of ran into, when we were tidying up the material with Lou in the beginning of the post-production. And she did a great job in like kind of putting order into this complete chaos. I mean, you try to imagine what the footage and the, like, would look like, you know, after a year and a half of someone being mostly a soldier, like most of the time the front lines of an active war. And as we were putting all this material in order, we kind of realized, and Lou also pointed out, that this is going to be like, this is not easy. This is quite, you know, this is quite disparate. This kind of thing is even mentioned in the film. That it was kind of, you know, a little bit all over the place. And I realized then, and it was almost, you know, a little bit humbling, because, okay, I liked, this was kind of almost a little bit, I developed almost a little bit of a style of filmmaking, like without narrative, with just a, and I, you know, I had this idea, and by now, not even by now, by much before, I realized that this was not realistic, like for this film to be able to be made, to have like a flow, it definitely needed the and more, that is, but it definitely, maps and other things that we added after all, but it definitely needed the narration. It definitely needed like this voiceover of my own like narration. So that's one thing that I was in the beginning like quite staunchly against, and then I just had to admit that that's just a stupid, that like that it's just not going to work, and I have to just let this go, you know, and just do this differently, you know, find like more normally, if you like, more as in a more like usual way or whatever. So that's one thing that changed. Other things along the way, I guess along the way, we also decided to put it in chapters. That was not very far from the way I was kind of thinking about it or envisioning it. and that it would be divided in chapters. I guess it's not, it's like a very discreet presence in the film, but you know, it's different how you see the film and like in the process of making it. It was kind of an important decision to make, to put map, to make like to somehow incorporate a map. This was quite a challenge, you know, to like to do this, how like how to do this in with all the artistic considerations and you know, and so on. I'm quite happy with what we ended up with. I actually did a lot of this mural, like part of this mural myself. No, I'm not sure if everybody realizes this the first time it appears on screen. I mean, the second time there's, you know, it's anyway, let's not do spoilers, but it's you know, it's obvious. But yeah, anyway, we made a whole mural of a map to, and we incorporated the map of the area like that with images of this mural, which by the way exists until today in a secret location in Athens.
I imagine your second trip was a lot easier than the first.
Yeah, absolutely. This is also mentioned in the film. Like this time around, I was there, you know, just as a journalist, not a soldier. So it was an entirely different, it was much more professional as well in a way, the way it was conducted and everything. And the whole thing, like the whole the travel itself was much different, you know. I just like passed through with a car, you know, instead of like, you know, crawling through the fields and stuff and making a kind of what do you call it, a clandestine walk of several hours and then crossing the river with a boat in the middle of the night, you know, and so on. So yeah, for sure. It was much more chill. I was there as a journalist. There was no active front. It's not only that I was not a soldier, there was also no war, you know, at the time. And yeah, it was like the work in that sense was much smoother.
This is a war film, right? It's just so unlike any other war film I've seen.
You know, I mean, well, what did Marx say that, you know, the history of everything hitherto is the history of class struggle? Yeah. I guess, yeah, in that regard, like, yeah, I guess it's definitely, it's deeply a war film. Yeah, and I think definitely if you phrase it as a war film, like, you'll never see another war film like this. Like, you know, if you only ever see one war film in your life, let it be this one.
It's definitely not a war film where we follow a marquee actor laying down hate on the bad guys, cracking Marvel-esque one-liners.
Yeah. It's not the Audie Murphy story or whatever. It's the real deal of, you know, a lot of different people, and no one really is the superhero, or I mean, there are some villains, I'm not gonna lie, but you know, it's a much more even perspective, I think, on the narratives of, you know, there's no main characters.
And it's so much less action than most war films tend to be, including other war documentaries. In the end of the first fight, in the end of the fight at the Battle of Raqqa, there's this fighter asking for what seems like an eternity as far as a firefight's concerned, "Can I kill this man?" And it just takes forever for what a filmmaker would call action to actually happen. Here you can't see the whole story, you only see the back of this fighter. In the middle of it all, you get themes of the fog of war and battle ethics and the desire to survive.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Also, to build on that, like, I think it's very unique in a war setting, or especially in the context of the Battle for Raqqa, to see a soldier that's where the culture of the unit is to not shoot first. In urban conflicts, especially in you know, ones as bloody as Raqqa, the I guess the discipline of and the culture of the YPG is very unique. And like, you know, we had a lot of people who were from Western NATO militaries show up, and they, you know, a lot of times would be, you know, disciplined for being too trigger happy or not asking to shoot, you know, before enough, basically. So I think that's also, I get what you're saying about perspective, but also the perspective of, you wouldn't see that in a lot of war films where they're in the middle of a firefight and he's still asking permission to engage.
Yeah, because that guy could have possibly been on their side, or your comrades could have been hidden just on the other side of him.
Yeah, for sure. Because, you know, at the end of the battles like that, you know, the friendly fire is the highest issue. And, you know, because you're basically, there'll be one dude in a house and you'll be 360 surrounding him. So, you know, if you miss or you think anybody is the wrong guy, you're shooting a fellow comrade. So it is very important to have that sort of discipline.
Right. Or even just a guy, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. Just a normal guy. I mean, at that point in the battle, that would be one hell. That's a movie to himself, how that one guy got into the last dash house of Raqqa. But yeah, no, of course, in normal context of war, also, that's also why it's so important, because then what, you're going to spend the night in that house right next to the family whose, you know, brother or husband you just killed? Like, yeah. That's not a good way to do politics.
Right, like you came to liberate their city, but like ended their bloodline.
Yeah, exactly. And like, obviously, you know, war is made up of humans, as I made it before. And, you know, obviously there's mistakes. But I think if you're really into, I mean, if you're listening to the SRA pod, you kind of understand. And I would always like to point out, and I'm always very proud of the fact of the amount of discipline that I always saw for not just civilians, but also for the enemy.
Yeah, it definitely gives me a sense that it respects the intelligence of the audience. It doesn't keep the story moving by these action set pieces, but like individual stories and narratives of the people involved, including like primarily non-combatants.
It is exactly this particular process of production from which, to some extent, some of the weaknesses derive, we could say, it is exactly this same process of production that gives it its strengths as well. Its particularity, let's say. It's almost uniqueness, you could say, because here you don't have a typical situation where a professional crew of filmmakers or journalists like travel to the field, spend like a few weeks there, conduct some interviews, hope to catch a little bit of action, then, you know, fly back to Europe. The whole material goes to the editing guy and so on and so forth. Like here you have a, let's say, like a fundamentally different dynamic of production, because I myself was a soldier for a year and a half in this war. And apart from the more obvious, let's say, the more obvious benefit of having like the author of any work really be part of the narrative that they are narrating, of the be in the thick of it, you know, of the topic. I like to point out something else, something less, slightly less obvious. That there is also, if we think about it, in the vast majority of cases, the fundamental material, the fundamental building block of a documentary is the speech of the subjects. In other words, the interviews. And in this case, you have a rather unique dynamic where in many instances, the people I'm interviewing are people that we fought together in the front lines. So this affects the quality of the discussion. It affects how the speech is expressed and recorded. And this is a kind of dynamic that, you know, no other journalist can reproduce, you know, no matter how great they are as a journalist, or how, like, what if they have a big channel behind them, or a big international newspaper or whatever. Like, this is the particular value of this film in this sense, that that it sheds light, it provides a view from within, you know, in an insight from within into such extreme and historical events.
Why do you think this story is so important to tell?
Well, I would say the story is important to tell because it's a snapshot that gives you an understanding and can, I think, give you a glimpse into what I view as the largest sort of political upheaval or rewriting of, as you know, as the indoctrinated would say, capitalist modernity into sort of this new democratic society. And I think that the film does a good job of showing what that looks like, you know, up close in a real way that isn't sort of you know, eye in the sky propaganda or like doomer, you know, there's no point in doing anything nihilist. It shows an accurate depiction of what happens when you really try to do the thing, or you know, if you're put into a position where the thing is happening, it shows that change can happen and it's real.
What should viewers keep in mind when watching this movie?
I would hope that they see how similar people in a war zone are to themselves or everyone else. I would hope that they would walk away with a deeper sense of empathy for all the humans involved, and you know, just I guess what as people say now, like the othering, to not like other those in conflict just because you think that, you know, it's something that you can't imagine, so therefore they must be different people. I would say that, yeah, that's what I hope people would walk away with.
I definitely see that as a strong theme in the movie. It follows a lot of individuals who are both directly and indirectly involved in the fighting, as well as those who seem like they have no place in the fight. Like the children getting their school rebuilt, right? Or the dude building berms, he kind of just seems like a dude with a backhoe.
Yeah, totally. And with, you know, chutzpah, for sure. But yeah, just a guy with a backhoe.
Do you know if that was an intended thread in the film?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as I mean, I don't want to speak for anyone else's political outlook, but I think from an anarchist perspective, and especially an anarchist engaged in fighting a war, which, you know, can be a contradictory thing at the face of it, like centering everyone you come across as, you know, no one's the guy driving the backhoe isn't any more or less real than the person who's driving or flying the plane to drop the bomb, who's not any less real than the person who the bomb's landing on. Like, you know, it's a mosaic of people that raised to do anything in society. So centering that mosaic and how everything is interconnected is, I think, a deeply ideological statement.
So Guy tells me this isn't your first documentary.
No. It's my first more professional or semi-professional, however you see it, I don't know, more like feature length professional standard kind of documentary. I've done some very much more amateur / student films before, one about Thatcherism, in fact, which was like 70 minutes, I think. But it was, it's a different level of, it's much more DIY. Decent interviews, though, like decent narrative. I've done another couple of like short documentaries. That was a million years ago as well. One about the gentrification of a sort of black neighborhood, Aboriginal neighborhood in Sydney, Australia. I was an exchange student there for a semester. And another one about the unionizing of sex workers. Like small, very amateur stuff, a long time ago. But by now they have this, I guess, some kind of archival and historical value. I will most likely, drop this stuff on my Patreon at some point or something for anyone who finds it exotic.
What does Belke Sibe mean?
Belke Sibe means maybe tomorrow. And this is a kind of a two-layered idea and decision to call it that. Like on the one hand, it's kind of an inside joke, because anyone who has been in Rojava instantly recognizes the significance of the title. Belki Sibe was a very common phrase, sometimes even just Sibe, which is tomorrow. It was a very commonly repeated phrase. There's even a more complete version of the phrase, which was Nabelie Belki Sibe, which would translate as it's not clear, maybe tomorrow. And this was said, like this maybe tomorrow was said as was like a potential response to all sorts of requests and inquiries, let's say like that. Like it could be anything from when is the commander coming back? When are we getting the new ammunition? When will I get my glasses, fixed? Like I can't shoot without, all sorts of inquiries. Now I'm saying like more mundane stuff, but about anything. Like it was a very common answer that would mean fuck knows, basically. And it, in that sense, like it reflects this like somehow typical of every conflict zone, you would say, like this uncertainty and fog, to mention that as well, like about everything, this unclearness about everything, about every eventuality, let's say, what might or might not happen. We used to say, I can mention a couple of things that one thing is that people would love to joke and to like compare this to the famous mañana from the Spanish Revolution. So it's basically, this is a direct point of reference to put like Belki Sibe was like the mañana of the Spanish Revolution that George Orwell was talking about, among others. I remember we also used to sometimes, some of us anyway, used to say that one thing that Rojava taught us is to never believe anything, like that anything will happen or that until we see it happening, like until we see it happening with our own eyes. So it is a lot about this uncertainty. And on a more, let's say, on a deeper level, it is about the uncertainty of the revolution itself on a historical scale, like it is meant to imply how this revolution is both unfinished and uncertain in its trajectory, like uncertain in its uncertain about its survival, even. Like we've seen, and there's like a lot of developments now, you know, and things like that. And even right now, although there was a point where it seemed like that the most direct existential threats seemed to be like pulling away a little bit, even right now, and for this whole time, really, the revolution is surrounded. It's surrounded by enemies, and it always was. And it is not even certain if it will manage to survive, let alone thrive, because that's all. As I said, that's also another implication that this is an incomplete revolution, and it hasn't reached even like the potential and the ideals that it proclaims. It's work in progress. And so all of this is meant to be reflected to some extent with this Belki Sibe, like, you know, this is not finished yet. This is not done yet. It's not even sure if it can keep up. And we'll see. We'll see in the future, like maybe tomorrow. For now, it is what it is. And for what it's meant to be, maybe tomorrow. Something like this.
At risk of further making you sound like an auteur, it doesn't seem like this movie was made with any sort of industry backing. Was that a struggle for you?
If we're honest, like the main reason why it took so long and it was so difficult and exhausting to finish this film is because this film was made with a very, very small budget. Like in terms of festival language, for example, as I've recently myself discovered, there is a special category apparently for this sort of budget. It doesn't fall in the category of low budget. It falls in the category of no budget. And it's not, you know, it's not easy making films that way. But this is, I guess, because there is a further particularity of this film that it was made without any kind of institutional funding, without any sponsors whatsoever. And in fact, not even a production company behind it. It's somewhat DIY in that sense. And in fact, it was not even, and it's like it still isn't, it's not even for sale. Like you're not going to see it on a platform, you know, or on television for that matter, or even going to like in a normal cinema distribution or whatever. It has been played in cinemas with like DCP and all for like the digital cinema package format and so on. But even in that case, it was a special arrangement with the cinema owners, and it was screened with a free entrance and an option for a donation, as you would say, or as we call it in Greek, a free contribution, which, you know, is in this case, in the case of a screening, is usually there's a physical way to contribute. You know, there's like a box where you can put in cash. I understand that a lot of people in the Northern Hemisphere hardly use cash anymore. So because of that, there is also the possibility to contribute like online, like digitally, if you like, through the film's official page, belkisibe.com.
How can viewers watch the movie?
Well, right now, it hasn't been released yet. As I was mentioning before, given the nature of the film, that, as I said, it's not gonna be sold, yeah? So it's meant to be published online, yeah, at some point. And this is still it's kind of a Nabelian situation with this. Like it's not clear, probably soon. Is kind of there's even some technical issues. Like I'm a bit concerned that how this is gonna go down with YouTube, and if it's gonna, like, if it's gonna get not even demonetized, but if it's gonna get dropped completely, or even if I end up losing my channel, you know? Because let me tell you, there is an army, a horde of Turkish nationalist trolls out there. So there is even some considerations like that, like what happens, what kind of maybe like extra processing. I need to make a new copy with some little details processed a little bit to have less ground for the movie to be like whatever, like dropped, you know, like taken down. And also I have to figure out a kind of a backup plan, you know, which it seems, I don't know, I've heard various suggestions, but they're all quite, how to say, marginal, you know, like, so that's one thing there. But also, well, and here's the other thing, like the idea, it's almost, it's pretty much, the time is pretty much ripe. And one of the reasons I haven't started the process of the very last thing of putting together all the last things, like I was saying, to publish it, is because there was an idea that I would publish this right after the American tour. Yes. So because I've been planning for a considerable amount of time, over a year now, more than a year now, maybe even a year and a half, in fact, to make an American tour. I've been making various tours. Oh, also, I guess, just a small parenthesis here to answer, in case it's not clear yet, like, there is a lot of independent screenings that people have been going, like thousands of people have watched the film already in more than 100 screen, like, I don't know, like a three digit number of screenings in various places around the world. So, you know, people may be able to catch it in some whatever, like cultural center or whatever, Kurdish or whatever it may be, library, union hall, something, you know, in your city, you know, but also, like I said, specifically for American audience, I've been planning a, like, this is the most, let's say, the biggest and most like grandiose and optimistic tour project so far, like a almost 3 months, like the as much as the amount, the length of the visa, yeah, an almost 3 month coast to coast kind of live American tour. And this has been very difficult to organize because I have been in Syria and Iraq, I'm not eligible for the ESTA, let's say, for the quick and easy way to get an American visa. Instead, I had to go old school, you know, and like go for an interview in the American embassy and then like take medical exams and provide, like, you know, penal records and stuff like that, you know, a whole lot of things, which also led me, you know, like it is also partly why it took so long, because this also led me to think twice about it. And a whole lot of people, and I mean people mostly Americans, I mean also from around here, a whole lot of people seem to think, a whole lot of people were telling me, you're never gonna get in. That's people from here as well, and a whole lot of people from America were telling me things to the effect that, like, this is the worst time to visit the USA in, like, the history of the nation. And I was like, fucking hell, that is just my luck. You know, I've been planning this for very long. And now I'm just, you know, I ended up, you know, trying to do this in the worst time in the history of the nation. Well, there you go. Well, and I'm still doing it. I'm in fact, now that we're talking, It looks like I'm on the very last leg of this exhausting process of the visa, and hopefully, I should know by next week if I'm going to get the visa from the American embassy in Athens. And I say it like this because people have emphasized that even if I do get a visa from the American embassy in Athens, and I have it like stamped on my passport and everything, I could still be denied entry and like deported in who knows what kind of way just upon arrival, you know?
Yeah.
Just because any random clerk, like despite any visa, I mean, despite anything the American embassy has given me in Athens, what I've been told is that the random like clerk that will just, you know, look at my passport on any entry point can just decide like, and people tend to suggest that completely on a whim, like that it's just up to them. They can just decide that they don't like my face or whatever, that they don't want me inside the United States, and then I'll, you know, and then that's it. Which I gotta tell you, all of this is it sounds insane. But I guess I'll still roll the dice. I don't know. I know quite a few people in the States. I have some like contacts that could make this tour a real thing. So, you know, I would really like to do this. I think it's quite worth it. By the way, come to mention all this, anyone who is interested in putting up a show, and in fact, I encourage everyone for any reason at all, like to visit belkisibe.com, and in particular to have a look, you know, have a look at the trailer, have a look at the film, maybe donate something. And if anyone wants to be involved in putting up a public screening in their city, they can subscribe to the mailing list, or they can also email the page's address, the page's email.
These interviews were recorded in the summer of 2025. Since then, the U.S. government has refused to provide any updates to Alexis's visa, and as a result, his planned tour looks extremely unlikely. Alexis is now looking into publishing the film. This episode has been brought to you by the members of the Socialist Rifle Association. To join, head to socialistra.org.